Our fifth case for this morning is Heath against Wisconsin Bell. And whenever you're ready, Mr. Daler, we'll hear from you.
This is in Wisconsin Bell?
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Doug Daler of O'Neill, Cannon, Holman, DeYoung, and Lang on behalf of the plaintiff, appellant, relator, Todd Heath. This appeal arises from the district court's dismissal of a false claims case under the public disclosure bar. The standard of review is de novo. And this appeal essentially presents two questions. Was the relator's case based upon allegations or transactions that were publicly disclosed in an administrative report for purposes of the False Claims Act? And if so, the second question is, was the relator the original source of the information on which the case was based? The first, turning to the first question, it really turns on the question of whether the DOA contract is in fact an administrative report. Let me just ask you this.
If it is an administrative report, what is it about that contract that exposes the critical elements of the school contracts as fraudulent? It's just a contract standing by itself.
It's a contract that stands by itself, and it provides for schools, among other government agencies, to obtain certain prices for telecommunications services.
But you wouldn't know from that contract where that price stands in relation to anything else, would you?
Correct. That's correct.
So what I'm wondering is whether, I understand your argument about whether it's a report or not, and we have some language from the Supreme Court, the Schindler case and others, kind of recognizing the ambiguity of that. But what I'm wondering is whether the report that Mr. Heath makes is, quote, based upon these publicly disclosed documents.
Yes, and we contend, of course, that it is not based upon the document that really is the center of Wisconsin Bell's argument, which is the DOA contract, which it contends is a publicly disclosed document. It's not based upon that document because it's not substantially related to that document. You can't use that document in order to prove that there's been some sort of fraud, and that document alone doesn't prove any sort of fraud.
So this court talked about that in the Glazer case.
Correct.
For instance.
Correct. In the Glazer case, there was, of course, an investigation that preceded the filing of the complaint. And of course, the investigation fell squarely within one of the types of enumerated categories within the False Claims Act for which the public disclosure bar applies. In that case, the question was also raised as to what the relationship is between with the original source rule.
Mm-hmm.
And the original source rule, it was discussed in connection with this same question. And
how do you understand the original source rule? Do you have to be the original source of every scrap of information, or do you have to be the original person who connected the dots, even if individual items were out there in the public, or original source of most, or what do you understand?
I believe that you need to be the original source of the allegations that are the basis for your complaint, and that you can rely on publicly available information, as was done in the Lamers case. It's not necessary. If the rule was that you cannot rely on any type of public information whatsoever in this day and age with the internet and so on, all types of information would be public information. In fact, any whistleblower case that's based in any respect on a government contract, the government contract by its nature, because it is a government contract, is always going to be found in the public.
How do you describe public information, though? I mean, there's information that's in a file somewhere that could be obtained if anybody made an effort, but it's not public because it's never published.
That's right, and as I understand it, Wisconsin Bell's position is that anything that's in a government file anywhere would be considered public information of the type that could trigger the public disclosure bar, and I don't believe the law supports that, and that was discussed in Glazer as well, that the public disclosure bar does not go that far. So Mr. Heath is in many respects like the relator in the Lamers case in that he did do a great deal of investigation prior to the filing of this case, disclosed his information to the government, and in fact was the direct and independent had direct and independent knowledge of the things that he was alleging.
Does the record indicate that Mr. Heath learned anything in his capacity as the auditor for these school districts that he eventually concludes might be paying a price that's too high that was not public?
That was not public.
I mean, they are public entities, so I presume that some data is public. But
in his declaration, he talks about his negotiations with Wisconsin Bell, which would not have been public information. But he had discussions with Wisconsin Bell on behalf of the school districts where he was trying to get them to agree to charge what he believed was the appropriate prices. And he was being told by Wisconsin Bell that they didn't acknowledge initially that the DOI contract existed. And he said that they would not acknowledge that the schools were entitled to lower prices. So all of those discussions, negotiations, his understanding of the E-rate law and the investigation associated with that, all of that led him to come to the conclusion after some time that the law had been violated. And that is ultimately why he is the original source of the information. Congress intended to strike a balance with the False Claims Act between parasitic law, you know, trying to discourage parasitic lawsuits on the one hand, and on the other hand, actually just encouraging people to do the type of investigation and legwork that Mr.
He's Heath not had any other law, any other cases like this.
He had filed other cases, as is mentioned in the briefs, against other telecommunications companies at the same time.
Well, I meant apart from the.
No, apart from this issue, no. He's not a chronic whistleblower or somebody who's filed a number of different cases. He's a telecommunications consultant that, like Mr. Lamers in the Lamers case, was very interested in these issues and did a great deal of investigative work. There's no evidence in the record whatsoever that the government was aware of these types of issues at any time before Mr. Heath filed his case.
And he went to the U.S. attorney when, about 2008 or so, with his file, so to speak.
He did in August of 2008, and there's, I believe, a relator statement in the file that indicates that, as well as the complaint alleges that. So he did, in fact, go and disclose the case to the government in advance. So for these reasons, we believe that the district court erred in denying or dismissing the case based on the public source rule, and reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Metropoulos.
Thank you.
It's still good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad you checked.
Yes.
May it please the court, I'm Jim Metropoulos of Mayor Brown, LLP. I'm here on behalf of the defendant, Appalee Wisconsin Bell. This case is not about some document sitting in a government file cabinet. The district court dismissed this case because it is about a publicly disclosed transaction, a contract between the state of Wisconsin and Wisconsin Bell called the DNS agreement.
But, you know, your brief is very insistent about that, but I don't see how the VNS agreement is substantially similar to Heath's allegations at all. It doesn't say anything about the E-rate program. It doesn't. It's a piece of data at best, and you know, may wind up even being an irrelevant piece of data, but it's one of the pieces of data that suggests that what Mr. Heath's clients were paying was too much. So your effort to make this only about whether the VNS agreement was a good agreement or not seem incomplete to me.
Well, let me try to clarify then, Your Honor. What's going on here is the complaint is a lowest corresponding price complaint.
Right.
The essential element is, what is the lowest corresponding price? My opponent's source for that, the only source, is the VNS agreement.
No, I don't think so, because he has several clients. He says that Fond du Lac is paying $13 per line, Burlington $13.25, Grafton $16.44, Cudahy, I'm probably mispronouncing.
Close enough.
Okay, $20. In other words, he's got all these different prices, and he. So your VNS agreement is part of the evidence, but this goes to my connect the dots concern, actually, too. The VNS agreement is not something that goes to the fraud. It doesn't say anything about that.
Well, it is, as you mentioned, an important part of the alleged fraud.
It's a piece of evidence that the price may be too high for some of these districts. But even if you deleted it altogether from the record, he still is alleging that some districts are paying too much.
Well, he's alleging that they're paying too much, but in order to, the regulation says you have to have a lowest corresponding price.
Why not Fond du Lac, then?
Well, he didn't pick Fond du Lac. He doesn't say any of these are lowest corresponding prices. He doesn't say any of them are lowest are corresponding prices.
Why does he have to do a 12B6? He's alleged that some of the prices are not lowest corresponding prices.
Okay. Well, again, it was alleged that all of them are not lowest corresponding prices, but even if we put
aside...
Maybe
he wins on some and he loses on some, but I just see this as a piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole... case.
Well, obviously we have two pieces. We have the prices that were charged to the schools, and we have the VNS agreement, which my opponent contends is the demonstrator of the fraud, the lowest corresponding price. Even first off, once you have a complaint that is partly based upon public disclosure, that is sufficient to make it based upon public disclosure.
Oh,
that's
I don't
what
know
Glaser
about
says.
That. That's an interesting legal question. Because the Supreme Court doesn't seem to have said as soon as you have one piece of public information in the picture, there's no QI-TAM case possible. I can't find a single case that said that.
Well, Glaser, however, says that the language of the statute says based upon, not solely based upon. But let's shift, even if we shift focus to the actual prices that were charged to the schools, those are publicly disclosed as well.
But Glaser also says a relator's FCA complaint is based upon publicly disclosed allegations or transactions when the allegations in the relator's complaint are substantially similar to publicly disclosed allegations. Where's the allegation in the contract?
Well, the Act talks not only about allegations, but allegations or transactions. A contract is a classic transaction.
Well, you're not... quoting Glaser, though. You're moving beyond Glaser.
Well, yeah, Glaser talked about the literal language, that happened to discuss allegations. But in what we have is we have an act that says allegations or transactions.
And what about the key question is whether the government is already aware that it might have been defrauded and can take responsive action, or the language we used in the Levesque case, the residents versus teaching physicians case?
Well, the government has the two critical pieces of information. It has the actual charges. Those are disclosed publicly to the Universal Service Administrator, which is the entity that is responsible for reviewing claims. And Bank of Farmington and Glaser tell us that's a public disclosure. Then we have the VNS agreement, which is another publicly disclosed transaction. And according to my opponent, that is the essential element of the fraud. That's
right.
What demonstrates the fraud of the prices that were charged to the schools. It's demonstrated because they're all higher than this number that's
right.
In the VNS agreement.
So your legal position is the False Claims Act is not available anytime snippets of information are available throughout the internet, and the relator is the only person who understands how they connect together to reveal fraud.
Well,
you say that's off the table.
I wouldn't go that far because.
But you have gone that far, actually.
Well, I wouldn't say this is. We're not talking about snippets. We're just talking about two pieces of information, both of which are are publicly disclosed.
You're calling them two pieces. It's probably lots of pieces because there are quite a few school districts, and there's Mr. Heath's own investigation.
Well, and this is also an issue that was addressed in Bank of Farmington, where the court said, "Look, there may be a case in which something is completely beyond the normal understanding." But if all we're looking at is arithmetic and we're taking two pieces of public information, one says yes, one says no, and here it's one says $12, one says $9, and there's a difference, and you say that's a fraud, then that is a public disclosure.
Well,
and
what
that's
if it takes sophistication? This sort of goes to Chief Justice Wood's question. Sophistication to get there. I mean, it may be arithmetic, the computation, when you finally arrive at those numbers. But to get there through the internet or however you do it takes sophistication that the average person doesn't have.
Well, none of that's been demonstrated, and it's a straightforward claim.
But
it's
that's
like,
for the merits, surely.
No, but when faced with a motion to dismiss, my opponent has the burden of establishing jurisdiction, and if there's something outside of these two public documents that makes it so complicated that we were talking about something more than just $9 versus $12, then he's got to come forward and explain that, which he didn't do.
Well, he has, I think. In a way, so I take it you think Lamers was wrongly decided.
Oh, no.
That's all public.
No, because Lamers is a piece of public information, which is firsthand observation on the street. That's not one of the enumerated disclosures in the Act. What we have here are two pieces of information, which are both publicly disclosed via administrative reports.
But so is information on the street publicly disclosed. Anybody who walked through the streets of Green Bay could have observed the same thing.
True.
Really, that's public disclosure.
True, but the streets are not a form of public disclosure set forth in the Act. And an administrative report, which is the VNS agreement, it was reported to the world by the Department of Administration on the Internet and also in public records requests. Those fit the broad definition of an administrative report under Schindler and under Graham County.
It takes
those are
Schindler
listed
a step beyond. The court actually says, Relator's argument assumes that records released under FOIA but not attached to a written FOIA response do not fall within the public disclosure bar. We do not decide that question. So Schindler doesn't go as far as you're saying.
Schindler didn't directly decide the issue, but
right.
the district court applied the language of Schindler, or what we look at is the language of Schindler and what it talks about.
And this wasn't a report. This was more like an attachment to a report,
but
the Supreme Court has talked about it.
But it is part of the report.
Well, nobody summarizes anything. They just sort of slap the contract out there.
Well, but at the same time, first off, I would disagree that it was just slapped out there. But the more important point is what Schindler said. Not only did it address the direct situation before, but it interpreted the statute and said, report is to be construed broadly, anything that gives information. And what we have here is something that gives information. And the Supreme Court specifically said, there does not need to be any synthesis of the information. There does not need to be any hint of wrongdoing.
So everything is a report. Every written word produced by the government is a report. Because you can probably glean some information from everything.
Everything that is put out by an administrative agency under the language of the statute as it existed back then, yes. State agencies have since been excluded, but that amendment of the statute is not retroactive.
No, we don't have to worry about that, right.
Right. So we're not looking at any piece of information. What we're talking about is a piece, a contract, a transaction, in the words of the Act, that discloses what to my opponent is the essential element of the fraud. Now,
but nothing that indicates that it's fraud. I mean, it's like a piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole thing. A contract in isolation doesn't tell you whether the price is too low, just right, too high, anything. It's just a data point.
Put together with the other piece of information
exactly.
that is in the government's hands, the hands of the responsible administrator, mm-hmm. which is reviewing claims, it is.
And the government didn't know that there was any conceivable fraud problem until Mr. Heath came to them.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that way. I mean, under the Act, it's not a question. Well, under the Act and under the Supreme Court's decision in Schindler and Graham County, it's not, well, did it land on the desk of a DOJ attorney?
Exactly.
The question is,
was
it publicly disclosed within one of the vehicles that are set forth in the Act? And it was.
And then you have to have based upon and you have original source, but your brief certainly covers those points.
We covered them all, and we talked about Lamers. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions? Apparently not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Taylor?
Not questions.
All right. Then thank you very much to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.